The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Did you know that our federal government spent $413 billion on interest payments just last year? Which means in 2010 alone, we spent more on interest payments on the debt than we spent on the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Transportation, more than the Department of Energy, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of HUD, the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Agriculture, the Department of Commerce, the Treasury Department, Department of Labor, and the Small Business Administration. Combined, how bad is our government addicted to debt? Well, consider this, that since 1988, our Congress has spent over $8 trillion in interest payments alone. And a lot of that is going to other countries, making them prosperous, not us. How big of a number is $8 trillion? That's enough money to give a Lotus Evora dream car to every taxpayer in this country. And if that doesn't scare you, maybe this will. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, by the year 2021, which is only 10 short years away, our interest payments will reach a mind-boggling $1.1 trillion a year. That's 1.5 times more than we spend now on national defense. And that's not the worst of it. Hold on to your hats for this one. By the year 2046, every single dime of federal tax revenue received by Washington, D.C. will be spent on, well, you guessed it, just interest payments alone. Not $1 left for anything else. How hard will it be to pay off this debt? To put it in context, if Congress stopped all spending today and did not spend a single nickel on anything else, and they made payments of $100 million a day, it would take us 389 years just to pay off our national debt. So remember, when you hear politicians talking about reducing the deficit, they are not talking about reducing the debt, and it will be the debt and the interest on that debt that may just be the downfall of the greatest republic this world has ever known.
Hello, everybody. This is Richard Martin, the Wake Up Call, coming to you on Monday, the 25th of April, 2011. And I wonder what it takes to make people really wake up and understand these things. The figures, my understanding in themselves, I've seen various different ways to try to bring it home to people, you know, piling stacks of dollars up and having them reach the moon and back and things like that. But the figures are so unrealistic that it numbs the senses. So I do fear that the reality will come in the form of a collapse such as we saw in 2008, though much more serious, and there certainly will be no recovery for the following 2 years after that one. That will be definitive. That will be like the housing collapse. I just read this from Reuters. The world's banks face a $3.6 trillion wall of maturing debt in the next 2 years, which must compete with debt-laden governments to secure financing. And that came from the IMF on Wednesday. Many European banks need bigger capital cushions to restore market confidence and assure they can borrow. And some weak players will need to be closed, according to the International Monetary Fund in its Global Financial Stability Report. The debt rollover requirements are most acute for Irish and German banks, with as much as half of their outstanding debt coming due over the next 2 years, the fund said, and I quote. These bank funding needs coincide with higher sovereign financing requirements, heightening competition for scarce funding resources, again, according to the IMF. Well, when both big banks and sovereign entities are simultaneously facing twin walls of maturing debt, it is reasonable to ask exactly who will be doing all the buying of that debt, especially at the ridiculously low and negative, I might add, interest rates that the central banks have engineered in their quest to bail out the big banks. Where are they going to find the $3.6 trillion? Ladies and gentlemen, it's game, set, and match. It's over. It's no wonder people didn't believe there's an economic recovery underway. And for the first time since the Great Depression, households are receiving more income from the government than they are paying the government in taxes. The combination of more cash from various programs called transfer payments and lower taxes has been a double-barreled boost to consumers' buying power while also blowing a hole in the deficit. Households received $2.3 trillion, some kind of government support in 2010. That includes expanded unemployment benefits, as well as payments for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and stimulus spending, among other things. But that's more than the $2.2 trillion households paid in taxes, an amount that has slumped largely due to the recession, and that's according to an analysis by the Fiscal Times. The 1930s offer a cautionary tale. The only other time government income support exceeded taxes paid was from 1931 to 1936. That trend reversed in 1936 after a recovery was underway and the economy fell back into a second leg of recession during 1937 and 1938. Well, the $38 billion cuts, so-called, agreed between the President and Congress, work out to approximately $3 billion less in spending each month, or less than the amount the Fed has been pouring into the Treasury market each business day for the past 5 months. The fact that a major write-up on the budget finds it meaningful to tell us about specific $8 million cuts, that's an M, by the way, a million of an M, that tells us that we're not yet at the serious stage of these conversations. After all, $8 million is only 0.0005% of the 2011 deficit. And even the entire $38 billion is just 2.3% of the deficit and slightly under 1% of the total 2011 budget. How much is $38 billion? Less than 2 weeks of new debt accumulation on average, about 2 weeks of Fed thin air money printing, also known as QE2. In other words, it's a drop in the ocean. It is this lack of seriousness that is driving the dollar down and oil and gold and silver and other commodities up. It is the reason we will be watching the TIC report for clues that foreign buyers and holders of dollars are getting nervous about storing their wealth with a country that is increasingly seen as unable or unwilling to live within its means. It explains why the IMF has been finger-wagging so much of late. Somehow, the U.S. federal government managed to increase its expenditures by 30% from 2008 to 2011, but is now struggling to reduce the total amount by just 1%. That, my friends, is an out-of-control process, and the 1% in so-called cuts is simply not a credible response to a very large problem. All right, this is Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call, and we are coming to you live from Singapore through PRN in New York City. If you would like to call into the show, which, of course, as always, we would love you to do, please pick up your phone and call 888-874-4888. That's a toll-free number to the studio, and I shall be able to contact you through the system and answer your questions. Again, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. If you'd like to email your questions, you can do that too. We have an email facility here, and that email address should be rm@gfawd.com. Again, rm for Richard Martin, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And if you would like to call me with questions about your own situations in private, please do so by calling my direct line in Sarasota, Florida, which comes through to Singapore, at area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's area code 941-441-1682. Please call any time during the day or night. Our hours are completely different, so it really doesn't matter when you call. If I'm not answering the phone, leave your name and phone number, and I will call you back. All right. Well, we need to talk a little bit about inflation and deflation. There's a lot of polemic still going around, a lot of unfortunate misunderstandings about the meaning of these things. And I spend a lot of time talking about it, but it's extremely important because one of the things that happens is that the powers that be, through their favorite media organs, try to get you to believe that inflation is responsible for the price of the things that you have to buy, such as gas, food, other things which are essentials, which are costing more. And they're trying to get you to believe that inflation is responsible for this because they want to hide behind the real villain and the culprit, which is none other than Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who has been throwing money wantonly into the system, which has simply been picked up by the speculators and thrown into the kind of things that have nothing to do with business progress, because there is no business, because the people can't afford to buy anything. So they just buy commodities, stocks, precious metals, oil, with this newly found money, or rather because of the run of the newly found money. It's not actually the money itself that does the buying, but suffice it to say that it is the perception of the liquidity of the QE2 which has caused people that has nothing to do with inflation. You see, for overall monetary inflation to occur, the total supply of all forms of money must rise. For monetary deflation to occur, it's the opposite. All forms of money must decline. So you see, monetary inflation or deflation isn't necessarily the same as overall price inflation or deflation. It is possible to have the money supply growing, for example, but have overall price deflation occur if the population size is growing faster than the total supply of money, and vice versa. Let's have a look at the Roaring Twenties. At the time, there was sovereign money, supposedly gold-backed, privately created credit money, and then massive amounts of margin was used to buy up stock, which inflated the price of equities. The aggregate of all three dramatically outstripped the growth in population, and overall price inflation broke out, especially in equities where margin was rampant. This created a bubble which was not supported by income, and thus the bubble burst in the year 1929. Note that having gold-backed sovereign money did not stop the bubble from being created. And this is because private credit and margin were not kept under control. And that is because we allowed the private bankers to be in control, and it was in their interest to let it get out of control, the very same thing that is happening today. Now, here's what most so-called economists either don't know or won't admit. Credit dollar creation is inflationary up until the point of debt saturation, which is when income can no longer support it. Once debt saturation is reached, then credit creation becomes deflationary. And this is why we had the wave of deflation that began in 2007 and roared into 2009. During the Great Depression, margin money and credit money were allowed to contract. That allowed debt to fall to the point that income could support it. And then real growth resumed. Today, we have failed to let derivatives, margin, and credit money contract. Income in the U.S. still cannot support more debt, and thus it is still debt-saturated. In comes the Fed to try something different, because we don't want to repeat the Great Depression. So instead of letting the debt properly default and let investors deleverage their margin, the Fed instead began transferring the private debt and leverage onto itself with a guarantee by the American taxpayer. Exactly what QE is. It is a shift of debt from private banks onto the general population. Doing this is money printing. It is simply indirect instead of direct. By taking debt instrument off the private banks, they are thus allowing the total money, that's all three types, to expand where otherwise it could not have. Understand this? In this way, the mechanics of QE are designed to fool you. They get to claim that at some point they will be repaid, but that is simply a game, because in the meantime, the banks are allowed to generate even more, and thus the total supply of money skyrockets. That's the fuel that creates the speculation. Now, my contention is that the total supply of money is unknowable because derivatives and margin are so out of control. Banks are effectively being allowed to fractional reserve to infinity, and thus producing nearly infinite leverage. This, of course, is not supported by income, and thus is guaranteed to fail. It is the creation of too much credit and too much general money that is the problem. It became a problem because we allowed private individuals to control its production. Think about it. Any individual, and even any politician, who is given the power to create money will find ways to create more of it. As the saying goes, give me that power and I'll show you how. Well, here is the argument of those who think increasing the deficits is the answer to the economic problems. Increasing the deficits may be the best way out of recession. And it's a lot cheaper, too. Because when the government borrows money to spend during a downturn, it stimulates economic activity, which boosts its revenues. That, in turn, reduces the size of its deficits. So it creates a virtuous circle that pulls the economy out of the doldrums and puts people back to work. It's a win-win situation. in theory, and if in fact stimulus funds are channeled directly into ongoing concerns that produce tangible goods and local jobs as well as infrastructure projects that create local jobs and income, that then stimulates demand for goods and services. Then the economic machine can start again. Such an easy argument to make, isn't it? Sounds so logical and seductive. Everybody wins. Unfortunately, this is not what past stimulus funds have been used for, and there is not a single shred of factual and highly correlated evidence that past stimulus has in fact added a single job, other than in the financial services industry, and of course maybe McDonald's, and to service massive salaries, bonuses, and incentives to package, repackage, and package again financial instruments and speculative investing that in fact results in the exact opposite of broad economic stimulus that creates jobs, income, and consumer demand in that zone of socioeconomic demographic where real value-added economic health is maintained, the middle class. The biggest fraud in the history of America simply continues. In fact, there is no intention whatsoever to bring back old days of a large middle class prosperity as the foundation for a robust economic system, if we ever really had one, which is highly dubious. And past economic stimulus policies are a fraud in this regard, and policymakers have no intention whatsoever of implementing a single policy that would serve to put any level of relative wealth back in the hands of the masses. In terms of their interests, it serves no purpose to do so from a global free market perspective. And in any case, if it were as easy as increasing deficits, why would anyone ever go bankrupt? Why would anyone ever lose their house to foreclosure? Why would there not be eternal wealth creation coupled with unlimited borrowing? Because that's the argument that needs to be addressed, and of course never is. Well, Greek two-year bonds now yield more than 19.3%. And that's up from 15.44% at the end of March. So where do the Greeks find 19.3% to pay this? Again, ladies and gentlemen, it is over. Let's just move on. The situation is out of control and clearly a catastrophe. When sovereign debt carries a rate of interest higher than nominal GDP growth, all that can ever happen is for the debts to pile up faster and faster. Clearly, the very last thing that can be allowed to happen if avoiding an outright default is the desired outcome. How does more debt at higher rates help Greece? Well, of course it doesn't. And what is clearly on the cards is default. Of course, termed restructuring by the spinsters in charge of everything. The main question to be resolved is who is going to eat the losses? The banks and other major holders of the failed debt, or the public? And I think we all know the most likely answer to that one. No, I read somewhere recently about an American blogger who's just spent some time in Ireland. And he was listening to Irish radio talk shows, which led him to the conclusion Irish talk radio is to American talk radio what fine literature is to comic books. Irish talk show hosts are uncommonly well informed, as are the listeners who call in. This is due to stations screening their callers for a measurable IQ before letting them on the air. They do not waste time letting just any dimwit rant about inconsequential BS like where someone was or wasn't born. It's refreshing turning talk radio into something more than a free-form seminar on the real pressing issues of the day. And when one of these Irish talk show hosts gets a politician to come on their shows, they have their facts in a row. You never hear one Irish politician on any of these shows getting away with pumping out talking points instead of answering the question posed. The host will simply not allow them to go on to the next subject until they've answered the damn question. It gets apparently so intense in some cases that you almost, that's almost, feel sorry for the poor politician. You wonder why they even go on these shows and subject themselves to this kind of abuse. The answer, of course, is self-evident. Either they put up the interrogations, or they don't get any airtime at all. Well, I'm afraid that's a message which is lost on the media in the United States. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think, I mean, I often feel like accusing these media pundits of sort of being unpaid shills for the government. In some cases, of course, I suppose they are. But the reality is much more mundane and sober. I think they're all just so stupid. They just don't know what they're talking about. They don't know the arguments. They don't understand what people are saying. They are just familiar and comfortable with the status quo. They're familiar with what they're being told by the politicians, and they just feel sort of mindlessly attacked by anybody who says anything different. That was part of a clip I showed a few weeks ago where two people were interviewing somebody who apparently accused them of being holding the water for Obama, and one of the two interviewers got all upset and flustered, and it was like she was being caught, you know, red-handed with being a shill for Obama and for the status quo. Not at all. She's just too stupid to know any different. They don't think, they're not taught to think, they won't think, and so, quite frankly, you just have to live with the stupidity and the kind of dumbing down process that we're also painfully familiar with on the media shows. Very sad and quite unnecessary and very stupid, but no, it's the politicians that are the evil monsters in all this. It's the politicians that are trying to get rid of, you know, public radio. Those are the people that really know what they're doing. But the media pundits, frankly, they're scared. They don't want to ruffle any feathers. They don't want to lose their jobs. You know, they've got mortgages to pay too. So they just take the easy way out, the easy road, which is one where they agree with what the government says and the major political and business figures, and they automatically take the side against any Tom, Dick, or Harry that comes on the air and tries to queer the pitch and say anything different and become kind of mindless, troll-like contrarians. I think it's as simple as that. All right, well, we are now ready for break, so we shall take the break, and I will be right back.
The most news anywhere on the internet. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, your number one source for everything progressive.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off! I said not to play it!
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny!
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Carol Brie, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com anytime, day or night, for all of our great shows. Don't be left out and miss important shows and information. Visit ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and be in the loop.
I'm Steve Lindman. I host the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's an in-depth truth hour, an antidote to government and corporate managed news and infotainment on the most important world and national issues affecting everyone. Distinguished guests are featured regularly to provide cutting-edge commentary and analysis not available from the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation on what everyone needs to know. The Progressive Radio News Hour is Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Well, I just got an email from Jerry, which is a piece of information from MarketWatch. The IMF has apparently just dropped a bombshell and nobody noticed. For the first time, the international organization has set a date for the moment where the age of America will end and the U.S. economy will be overtaken by that of China. According to the IMF official forecast, China's economy will surpass that of America in real terms in 2016. That's just 5 years from now. So there you have it. That's the official projection from the International Monetary Fund about when the economy of China is due to overtake that of the United States. So I got an email over the weekend from Frank Devlin, which I would like to read to you in full. It is, in fact, a clear and refreshing statement of what we've been talking about for so many months now. Here it is. Our unemployment system, like almost every system that the government oversees, has many shortcomings, but a good many people are facing dire circumstances, and the following bears careful thought only because it is the perception of so many desperate people. The following deals with unemployment, but it could also include infrastructure maintenance, serious energy exploration, police, fire, medical, and a host of services needed to maintain this society. All are being neglected due to the wrecked economy, and yet our leaders refuse to even begin a serious discussion and insult our intelligence by debating a quarter of a 1% cut in the budget of a bankrupt nation. As fiscal budgetary issues in states across the nation get worse, we can expect that there will be no relief for those who are simply unable to find labor. We have spent billions upon trillions fighting wars in the Middle East, bailing out other nations from natural disasters, providing foreign aid to buy allies, and stimulating economic recovery by purchasing worthless assets from even more worthless banks domestically and abroad. But when it comes to providing assistance for Americans right here at home, politicians immediately begin talking about the necessity of budget cuts, spending measures, and austerity. It's worth noting that while jobless claims are hovering at 400,000 new claims, it takes over 200,000 jobs to be created each month just to break even. Thus, we're still losing more jobs than we are creating. On top of that, thousands of Americans every week are losing their emergency unemployment benefits, often becoming totally invisible in the unemployment statistics because they are no longer looking for work. While pundits argue about whether or not we will have a double-dip recession, for millions of Americans, we are well beyond that, clearly within depression territory. According to John Williams of ShadowStats, if we utilized calculation methods for unemployment the way we did before 1994, and counted not just those who are unemployed or employed part-time and looking for full-time work, but those who are considered long-term discouraged, works like the people who have fallen off on emergency unemployment benefits. And the unemployment rate actually would not be 9.2%, as the government statistics indicate, but rather well above 22%. That's one in five Americans who want meaningful work but simply can't find it. It's also important to keep in mind that even with the official low-end statistic of 9.2%, there are over 15 million people currently unemployed in America. Some of them will find work, most will not. This means that at some point their benefits will be exhausted as well. Very grim. Well, let's take another email. I can find it. I thought I could find it, but I seem to have lost it. A couple more we had. Steve Kruger has not put in an appearance today, so we are obviously hurting in that regard, but nevertheless, we do have something from the financial crisis experts. The Senate has released its report on the financial crisis. It is a 650-page beast. The early reads have been fairly brutal. Goldman Sachs misled Congress after duping clients, Levin says. Bloomberg criminal charges loom for Goldman Sachs after scathing Senate report from Forbes. The Goldman report, last chance for perp walks. Fortune, Senate report lays bare mortgage mess. Wall Street Journal, Senate panel slams Goldman in scathing crisis report from Reuters. Naming culprits in the financial crisis from the New York Times. Well, the whole propaganda campaign about the business sector becoming financially flush rests on an entirely spurious factoid with respect to the balance sheet cash. Yes, that number is up a tad from $2.56 trillion in the fourth quarter of 2007 to $2.86 trillion at the end of 2010. Still, this endlessly trumpeted gain in cash balances of $300 billion is more than offset by the far larger gain in business sector debt, meaning that on balance, the alleged cash nest egg held by American business is simply borrowed money. At the end of the day, $10.9 trillion is a lot of debt in absolute terms, but based on the Fed data on the market value of business sector assets, it is also crystal clear that the relative burden of business debt has been rising, not falling. At the bubble peak in late 2007, business sector assets were valued at $41.5 trillion, but this figure had shrunk to $36.9 trillion by the end of last year. The grim reaper of real estate deflation has done its work in the business sector too. Consequently, total business debt now amounts to 29.4% of business assets, a considerable rise from the 25.2% ratio at the bubble peak in late 2007. What the bullish cheerleaders of recovery constantly forget is that in an epochal deflation like the present one, debts remain at their contractual amounts even as asset values wither. Well, a little bit of social comment at this point, I think, would be called for, ladies and gentlemen. Health Day comes the title, Obsessive Head Trauma in Infants Doubled During Recession Study. Apparently, financial stress may trigger violent behavior towards babies, according to the researchers. Recession-related stress may have triggered an alarming increase in non-accidental head injuries among infants, according to new research. The number of babies hospitalized for non-accidental head trauma, a form of child abuse previously known as Aiken Baby Syndrome, doubled during the recent recession. According to the study by researchers of University Hospitals Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. The reasons for why this is happening are beyond the scope of the study, but it may be that more parents are stressed to the breaking point because of economic problems like unemployment and foreclosures, said lead author Mary I. Wang, a fourth-year student at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, and I quote, "In many cases, when people are forced to leave their homes, they may be moving in with relatives who might not have as much of a vested interest in taking care of infants." According to Wang, who is scheduled to present the paper on Wednesday at the American Association of Neurological Surgeons meeting in Denver. Research presented at meetings is considered preliminary until it is published in a peer-reviewed journal. Then we have, from Fox News, the innocent victims of the recession. And I quote, "Child abuse cases on the rise in recent years. In Phoenix, a local hospital says that they've seen an increase in child abuse cases since the economy tanked. Medical experts blame stressed parents, overworked social workers, and budget cuts to CPS. Quote, "We are seeing a higher number of children that have more severity in their injuries," says Nicole Schuren, a hospital social worker. "I think that the children suffered paid the price for that," says Dr. Jennifer Geyer, "and they're sometimes paid with their lives. Statistics show that every day 5 children are killed by abuse in the United States, the vast majority of them under the age of 4. In the past few years, doctors locally have seen an increase in child abuse cases here in the valley. When parents hurt financially, children sometimes get hurt." And then from the Christian Science Monitor article entitled "Schools Facing Rise in Homeless Students." "Schools serving homeless children are seeing an increase in enrollment, straining their ability to serve the most vulnerable students. Experts say the economic recession has exacerbated youth homelessness, and schools serving this vulnerable population are now being challenged to keep up with the students and offer the unique services to which they are entitled under federal law." According to a 2009 report released by the National Center on Family Homelessness, an average of 1 in 50 children in the United States has experienced homelessness, which is defined as not having a stable long-term place to stay. This ranges from children temporarily living with an extended family member or family members to living in homeless shelters or inside cars. Then from the Salisbury Post, we have "Poverty, Moms Are Depending on SNAP." Laura Williams has been looking forward to going to the grocery store to shop for herself. After all, she works at the supermarket, but only recently has gotten on the food stamps program in order to buy what she sells to others all day long. Williams is a single mother of 4 children, ages 15, 8, 6, and 2. "My rent is more than I make per month at work," she said. "So it's kind of hard to get food, pay the bills, and make sure my kids get what they need. It's really, really hard," end of quote. As a result, she now participates in the Federal Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, the program formerly known as food stamps. The mother of 4 plans her food purchases for each month, periodically replenishing milk and other perishables, seeking to ensure her food supply lasts the entire month. And I quote, "When we go through the grocery store, everything is planned out for the whole month," Williams said. "The main thing is meats. I'll get them, and then we'll go get frozen vegetables, fresh fruit, stuff like that. Some of the unhealthiest food is also the cheapest to consumers. So for many people on a limited budget, getting more food often means buying food of limited nutrition. Whatever's on sale, Williams said, just to make it last throughout the month. Yeah, well, I suppose that is pretty self-explanatory. Very grim indeed. Okay, well, this is how Porter Stansbury sums up the situation. 10 years ago, America sat on a pinnacle of power almost unimaginable even 50 years ago. We controlled the world's reserve currency, and it was just a paper. We had no military rival. We invented the computer and built the internet. Our military, our corporate brands, and our banks dominated the world economy like no other empire in history. And then we went broke. How could that have happened? It is as if our success and power convinced us we could break the laws of economics with complete impunity, while breaking all history's blood rules too. Down payments? Who needs those? Everyone deserves the home. Home prices never fall. Besides, we'll just get AIG to insure those bonds. What could go wrong? Afghanistan? The graveyard of empires? We can handle it. What about a civil war-prone country, Iraq, with Stone Age infrastructure? Three rival indigenous tribes and a unifying religious-based hatred of Americans? Why not? Let's invade. We'll get the British to help. They had such success last time. And why bother managing all these government employees? Let's let them set their own wages and benefits. What could go wrong? Healthcare? Of course we can afford it. Let's toss in Viagra and other prescription drugs too. That'll get us some votes. Taxes? Nobody wants those. We'll cut them. How will we pay for all this? The rich will pay. Oh, that doesn't work? Well, we'll just keep borrowing from the Chinese. Have you seen what interest rates they'll accept? What a bunch of fools. Besides, everyone knows deficits don't matter. And so it went for nearly 10 years. You couldn't have written a piece of fiction with a more absurd twist. It doesn't make any sense. But that's exactly what happened. All right, let's take an email from Adrian, who writes, Dear Richard, having been through a very nasty long divorce, I'm about to receive $75,000 from the buyout of the marital home. I have a 401k that's worth about $75,000 too. Also, I'll receive half of my ex-wife's retirement, worth about $150,000. My ex-wife is 7 years younger than myself, therefore I don't expect her to retire anytime soon. We have an 11-year-old son. At 61, I'm not in a position to take great risk and will put the bulk of the money into short-term T-bills. That said, I do see that there is no safe investment outside T-bills. With the fantastic amount of debt this country is facing, the future is looking very bleak. Therefore, shorting stocks is an obvious choice. In a recent show, you've spoken about ETFs as a good investment. May I ask you to advise me as to how about investing $10,000 in ETFs on the downside? Also, what sectors and or which actual stocks do you see as vulnerable? In terms of timing, I'm guessing the $60 trillion question is, how long can Ben Bernanke keep pulling the wool over the eyes of the stock market? On the other hand, as Bernie Madoff said about Chase, they had to have known, and the market and the news media do know that Bernanke is pumping the market and are playing along. At some point, the market will act like a market and will yell, the emperor has no clothes. Can you please address what will trigger the impending crash? Is it Japan dumping U.S. debt for cash to rebuild? Or the BRIC countries agreeing on a new trading currency? Please include me in your email list. Thanks for all the work you do on our behalf. Regards, Adrian. P.S. Your recent commentary on the music industry was brilliant. All right, Adrian. Well, lots of questions there. And frankly, difficult to know quite how to address them all. I will say this, though. This very day, as I speak, ladies and gentlemen, the price of silver has made a tremendous rise in price, up to almost $50 an ounce. It is currently, as I speak, trading at $46.31. It has, in other words, undergone a tremendous, monumental intraday reversal, which very likely indicates the absolute end of the rise in the precious metals, at least for the time being. Gold itself also had a very strong rise today of some $15 an ounce and is now down on the day by half a dollar. Now, the reason I bring this up is because in answer to Kevin's, to Adrian's question, what could trigger the impending crash? Well, the most, as I think I've said this before, the most reliable news or information or factors that cause a crash which is of genuine duration, in other words, not just a quick profit-taking spree, but the most reliable turn in any market is no news at all. When the market, as in silver today, which I followed because being here in Asia, your overnight was my day, so I was actually following the move in silver more out of curiosity than anything else. The move was quite unprecedented in recent years and maybe for a few days prior to the big crash in 1980, it was unprecedented as well. But there was no news. There was absolutely nothing at all that indicated that a huge, monumental decline in the price of silver was about to take place. And as I say, I was awake, kicking, working in my office during the entire episode of your overnight, which is to say from midnight onwards, watching this unfold in front of my eyes. And it is one of the reasons why I have warned you against purchasing precious metals, because I was quite certain after the recent parabolic rise in the price, especially of silver, that there would be a reverse. I didn't know where it would come from. I had no idea that it would be today, and I had no idea what price would be the ultimate price of silver before the crash came. But I will tell you that these market turns come out of the blue with absolutely no warning whatsoever. The only thing I will say about the stock market, Adrian, in that respect, in answer to your question as to, you know, whether I could address what would trigger the impending crash, is that if this is the beginning of a down move in the metals, I think it's very likely that the stock market will accompany the move. Because if you look back, all moves, all downward moves in precious metals seem to have corresponded with a very big downward move in the stock market as well. So I'm thinking that the chances are very, very high that if the metals have fallen, copper, for example, is down 12.5 cents, a massive move today in the price of copper as well, which tends to lead the metals. It also tends to indicate the return of a recession. It's not called Dr. Copper for nothing. They call it Dr. Copper because the price of copper tends to indicate the future price of the economy. And if such is the case, the price of copper is most definitely heralding the imminent onset of a recession in the United States and elsewhere for that matter. So I would think that there is a good chance that we're seeing the top in all the markets, excuse me, and that we would be embarked upon the next leg down. And those of you with ETFs and short positions will be relieved, presumably, to hear me say this, but there is ample evidence, as I sent out in one of my reports this weekend, about the internal state of the technicals in the stock market, indicating very severe weakness, which is not evident to those who follow the indices, but to those who follow the internals of the market, and they will be able to see this for themselves. This will come, this downturn in the market will come as no surprise. All right, well now, as far as what to buy, I can't give you that kind of advice. Adrian, you will have to call me for that. It's not allowed by the authorities to give specific advice over the air, but I will be glad to do so if you would like to call me. You're right about the debt of the country. You're absolutely right about shorting stocks. Totally agreed with you there. I wish you all the best of luck, Adrian. And as I say, do feel free to call me anytime if you'd like some more information. Okay. I got an email from Jean, who says, "Dear Mr. Martin, I am a new listener and enjoy listening to your program every week from New York. Will you please advise me the following concerns? One, currently my husband, our five-month-old daughter, I are staying at our parents' place. We are thinking about buying a house since the interest rate is very low. In the event that both of us are out of a job, we could default. Is it a bad time to buy a house? Answer, Jean, yes. I believe that house prices are going to fall much further. There's an enormous supply of unsold houses on the market right now, and I think you will want to wait at least another 2 years before even considering buying a house. Okay, that's the first question. Second question. I have invested in some mutual funds, stocks, and 401ks. Should I sell them again? Yes, Gene, as quickly as you can. Don't know what the mutual funds are, don't know what the stocks are, or the 401ks. But all I can tell you is that when the market goes down, some 90% of stocks will go down with it. So I don't think I need any further information, Gene. Just sell those stocks and put the 401k money, along with everything else, into short-term treasury bills or into a T-bill money market fund. Question number three, is it safe to leave money in a brokerage firm such as TD Bank? Thank you so much. Best regards, Gene. Yes, Gene, it is. I believe it is. I will tell you that I have been always of the opinion that leaving money in a brokerage firm is safer than leaving it in a bank. I don't have an axe to grind. I know I'm working with a brokerage firm myself. But remember that when you leave money in a bank, the bank takes that money and they invest it trying to achieve a greater return than that which they have to pay you in interest. When you leave your money with a brokerage firm, the broker has to segregate your funds by law. And that is one of the primary things that you will find that brokers do. They always do it. You will never find a broker using customer funds in a stock brokerage context. That's why when the troubles came with Lehman and Bear Stearns, the stockholders lost money, the bondholders lost money, but the people who didn't lose money were the clients of the brokerage firm. So remember that. Brokerage firms can be safe places. How you invest is a very different matter. It does not protect you against your own investments. All right, Gene, I hope you enjoyed that. And everybody, thank you very much for listening. This is Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful week ahead. We'll be back with you on Friday. Take care. See you then. Bye-bye.